before we dive into today's episode, I wanted to let you know that you can follow Chat Cemetery on Instagram and Twitter at Chat Cemetery. There are links to those in the show notes. You can also support the show on Patreon, where I will be releasing bonus content for this show and my other podcast, Welcome to Geekdom. You can support for as little as a dollar a month to get access to all of that content. You can also rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Podchaser. Both are extremely helpful for the show. And now let's dive into today's episode. Hey everyone, Chat Cemetery is back. I'm your host, Deanna Chapman, and today I am joined by Sadie Hartman to talk about Chapelwaite. We are doing this episode very far in advance because we were both lucky enough to get some screeners, so we have finished watching it. But Sadie, how are you doing today?
I am doing really good, and thank you so much for having me on your show.
Of course, I am a big fan of your company, Nightworm. So for the listeners who might be unfamiliar, could you just do a quick rundown of what Nightworms is?
Yeah, absolutely. So Nightworms is a monthly horror fiction subscription company. I co-own it with my best friend, Ashley. And we basically just choose horror books that we want to read and that we know that other people are excited about. And we put them together in themed packages every month and ship those out relatively close to the first 2 weeks of the month. And then do it all over again the next month. And at this point, we've been in business for almost 3 years.
Congrats. That's amazing. I picked up Stephen King's Later through your package. So I was very stoked that that was included. And, you know, to dive on into Chapelwaite, for anyone who maybe missed this one, it is an Epics show, which I don't know too many people who have Epics. And, you know, it's an adaptation of the short story Jerusalem's Lot, which is only about 30-ish pages, you know, so it's not a super long story. And I was a little surprised when I saw it was going to be 10 episodes. I was maybe thinking something like in the 6 to 8 range. I was a little worried, I have to admit. How did you feel about that?
Yeah, likewise. I mean, I remember reading that story and being terrified. So it is a scary story, but it's also like in a format, like epistolary format. So it's back and forth letter writing. And like you said, it's very short and it gets to the actual action like within 5 or 6 pages.
Yeah, I was flipping through the story and I was like, oh yeah, this is the one that's the letters, because King's done so many formats with his stories and novels that my brain cannot keep track of all of them, because he's definitely done some different things. And I've read like The Plant and some of the stuff that, you know, he's done just through Kindle and whatnot. And I was like, oh yeah, this one's coming back to me now. So it was definitely interesting to see how they took those letters and turned it into a show.
Yeah. And I mean, right away I noticed, because I skimmed through the novella, I guess you could call it a novelette. I skimmed through it really quick just to see like, okay, did they touch on all the major points? And they sure enough did. I mean, they did touch on Chapelwaite, which is where its derivative of the name is actually the estate, is the name of the estate. And then Jerusalem's Lot is like the little freaky village that's like close to it. And then, yeah, I was kind of just skimming through and they hit on all of the major points from all the major episodes. I guess they just kind of like fluffed it up with extra stuff.
Yeah, I like talking about the cast when we talk about shows and movies, of course. And, you know, Adrian Brody is someone who I've always been familiar with, but I've never really watched anything he's been in somehow. So I was like, oh, okay, that's an interesting choice. I didn't really know what to make of it when I saw he was going to be in this. And I didn't really know anything about most of the cast, admittedly. And obviously, Emily Hampshire is sort of the next big name in this. And I will probably butcher some names, and I apologize. But then you have the three Boone children, Jennifer Enns, Serena Glomgoss, Ian Ho, and, you know, then you have just other characters coming in who have kind of been in other things, like Julian Richings, who plays Philip Boone, was in Kingdom Hospital.
Oh, okay. I thought he looked familiar.
Yeah, it's weird because you don't really get a good look at him in this throughout the whole thing. Like him and Steven, you're just like, okay, I see you in the dark there, but yeah. I can't really like make out any distinct features. So yeah. When I was looking that up, I was like, oh, that makes sense that that's who that was.
Yeah, and Emily Hampshire was from Schitt's Creek, so it was interesting seeing her in a period piece and then also in something serious. Mm-hmm. She really was outside of her character from Schitt's Creek, too. Like, she has this sort of, like, breathy way of talking, like a very quiet, breathy way. In fact, Adrian Brody's voice was similar. Like, they matched each other and, like, that he was always very quiet and kind of, like, not growling, but just like, what did I write down? I just like wrote how, oh, he, yeah, whispers and growls. Like a lot of what he's saying is very like these guttural ways of talking. And then she's very soft spoken and like kind of whispering everything.
Yeah. You also have Gord Rand, who plays Minister Burroughs, who ends up being a pretty big part of this story, which I don't think I expected at the beginning when we first meet him. It's like, oh, okay, you know, he's the local minister and that's kind of going to be his role, but that was not the case by the end of it.
Yeah, he has a major role. And I actually really liked him in the story. I thought he was a cool character.
Yeah, me too. And I don't know if there were like too many other people of note, really. You obviously have Trina Corcum as Mary Dennison, who ends up having a decent sized role by the end of this as well. You have Jenny Raymond as Alice Burroughs. You have sort of these somewhat familiar faces that I feel like they've played like character roles in a bunch of different shows over the years. So you're like, they look familiar, but you can't really name what they're in. So
I feel like this will be one of those episodes or one of those series where they will be identified later too, because I felt like the constable had a really good role. And like, now I'm going to be looking for him in other work because I just thought he did a really good job.
Yeah. And obviously with this focusing largely on the Boone family, Charles and his kids are going to be the main focus of the story. And you have Rebecca coming in to take care of the kids, sort of homeschool them because they're basically shunned from everywhere for not being as white as everyone would like, which, you know, 1800s, you got to keep it accurate. And that is very accurate.
Right. Right. Yeah. And they also, I guess, like the family coming into inheriting this estate, this Chapelway estate, have had just like some bad blood in the community. There's sort of like a storyline about mental illness and madness, and the community is just sort of like at arms as soon as they come into town.
Yeah, they blame one family who wasn't even present for this sickness that is spreading across the town, and they don't even really know what the sickness is. And, you know, I imagine medicine back then wasn't fabulous. And, you know, they probably didn't know what to do with that. But obviously, going into it, we kind of know what it's going to end up being. So for me, it was just fun to sort of see how that all unraveled, because it's like, okay, we know this is based on Jerusalem's Lot. We know vampires are going to come into play. But what they did was they held off on that for so long. You know, you get through the entire first half of the episodes and you're still like, okay, but where are the vampires? Pretty much.
Yeah, that's actually a really interesting point, because like I mentioned earlier, when you're reading Jerusalem's Lot, like if seriously, like 5 or 6 pages in is when, you know, the main character decides to hook up with his friend and go off to Jerusalem's Lot. And that's when they discover, you know, that there's been some other entity or some kind of malevolent species of people living there. And then I forget what exact page it is, but it's pretty quickly. The caretaker, which is in episode 1 or 2, but in the book, she straight up tells the guy, which I guess would be, you know, our character, Charles Boone. She says, "Some die not. Some live in the twilight, the shadows between to serve him." You know, so she's like telegraphing that there's these wicked people in the story right away.
Yeah.
But Chapelwaite, the show, is definitely a slow burn. Like, prepare to buckle up a little bit.
Yeah, at the beginning, she's literally just like, none of the girls are staying, bye.
Yeah.
It's like, okay. Yeah.
Peace out. Have fun in your haunted house.
Yeah. And I do want to talk about the house, too, because I think one thing this show does really, really well is how creepy they make everything, because you have the woods where, you know, you're seeing all of these people pop up and sort of defending Chapelwaite almost, you know, when that guy goes and he's like going to kill Charles Boone and all this stuff and he just disappears and they think Charles did something with them. It's like, no, we saw the creepy ghost vampire people, you know, get him, but they don't ever show them as vampires still in that moment. So you're kind of like, okay, we still know this is coming, but it's not coming yet. And the house itself, I mean, all houses from that time period just give you instant haunted house vibes because they've been around so long. You're like, this has to be haunted.
Totally. And like, they kind of like tap a lot of different haunted house tropes right away. So it's like, ooh, there's a spooky graveyard right here on the property. Ooh, there's these large paintings in the hallway with these, you know, the portraits are just like spooky the eyes follow you around. And then you have like no electricity. So you have lanterns. And then there's like a haunted cellar where somebody like reportedly died in the cellar. And, you know, it's just like every trope kind of like comes into play. And it's very much a haunted house story before it's anything else.
But it never feels like they're trying to pile all of this into the story and not have it, you know, come full circle, because you have that moment where he's talking about there being rats in the walls. And then we find out that there are literal hallways behind the walls. And that's what he was hearing.
Yeah. And also there's that one woman who actually is from Jerusalem's Lot, who like for the first like, I don't know, 5 episodes or 6 episodes kind of makes appearances here and there, like just kind of shows up randomly. It was kind of like almost Pennywise-esque how she would just kind of show up randomly and like somebody's outside folding sheets and there she is being all like spooky and creepy.
And then popping up in the barn.
Yeah, that's so like Pennywise, right?
Yeah. And it's funny because when you take a look at some of the houses just throughout King lore in general, too, you know, you have the Marston House, which isn't even in play in this series. And, you know, I'm rewatching Castle Rock season 2 at the time we're recording this, and that comes into play there. So I was like, oh, that's a nice little thing that's happening right now. And you have the house on Niebolt Street in It, and you just have all of these houses that have a very specific look to them, and they have all of these different kinds of haunted house elements to them, but none of the stories are strictly speaking haunted house stories, which I love. It's like he's adding this whole genre of horror really just as a small piece of the story.
Yeah, so you get like a multifaceted horror story. You get like haunted house, demon possession, vampires, madness, asylums. Like I loved in this show that an asylum played a part of it. I was like, ooh, now we get like a crazy experimental asylum story. That's sick.
Yeah. One of my only complaints with this, I think, is the fact that some scenes were extremely hard to see. Like,
yeah,
we were closing curtains and trying to have the lights off. And I was like, I still can't see.
Yeah. So also on the technical aspect, I also think like because the characters are very soft-spoken, especially Rebecca and Charles have this very breathy, almost like growling, whispering type of voice. And you have to turn it way up. And a lot of times I was listening to it with headphones just so I could like really hear what was going on, because like in the action sequences, all the noises are much more intensified and the talking is kind of underplayed.
Yeah, the mix was a little off for my tastes as well, because I understand why they're sort of whispering because they don't want the kids to hear and things like that. But even then you're just like, a little louder. This is a big house. Okay. I think the kids are far enough away.
Yeah, absolutely. I have under my notes for the first episode. So the first episode, just for transparency's sake, my husband tapped out on the first episode. He was bored. So I ended up watching the whole rest of the series by myself. And so the first episode is rough, I would say. You know, you just really have to like hang in there for the payoff, don't you think?
Yeah, because they're giving you this whole backstory within the first episode as to why they're going to Chapel Waite. So you kind of just have to wait and things will pick up once they get to Chapel Waite. But, you know, them dealing with the mom's death on the boat and, you know, doing a burial at sea sort of thing, it didn't really fit the tone of the rest of the story because it was really the,
yeah,
we're starting this at sea. And it's like, oh, are we just going to, you know, be at sea for a bunch of this? And it's like, no, we just need to give you this fairly long sea scene.
Exactly.
And then we'll start. And I think that is something that might be tough for a lot of people to sort of sit through. Because if I'm not mistaken, the stuff at sea took like the entire first half of the episode.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, my husband was just like really bored. I mean, it starts off with a huge jump. I mean, it's just like brutal, right? Mm-hmm. In the beginning. So it does grab your attention, but then yeah, it does shift off relatively quickly into these like dragging moments. But then yeah, I think every episode is kind of identified by some kind of crazy scene. Like there are some pretty intense scenes. The stabbings are very realistic. Mm-hmm. Anytime somebody is like stabbed or gored or whatever is like pretty intense. I will say too, like the special effects are really great. I thought that the last episode with darkness was really cool. Like there's the special effects are worth it. It's worth the price of admission for all the like scares and creepy shit.
Yeah, this is definitely better than a lot of the stuff I have watched, especially from like a production standpoint, because, you know, going through some of those 80s and 90s low budget TV series and miniseries and, you know, even TV movies at times, I was like, oh, you had no money.
Yeah.
And it shows, but in this, and I don't even know what the budget was for this, but, you know, Epix does put out like good looking shows. I think it's just the fact that it's on Epix. A lot of people miss out on those things. And, you know, that's probably a bummer for something like this, because I do think a lot of people who love vampire stories and love this time period would find something to enjoy out of this if they can, you know, stick with it through the first few episodes, because I do think it takes a minute to pick up. And then it's sort of like once you hit that halfway point, you're kind of going in the direction you know it's going to go. And they introduce Jacob and you actually go to Salem's Lot after that. So it does take a minute to really pick up some steam. And, you know, Sadie, for you, what were some of the big moments that stood out? You took many more notes than I did. So I want to give you a chance to talk about, you know, your favorite moments and things like that.
Yeah. So, I mean, like we were talking about, there's some like aesthetics that I really was picking up on. Like I loved the fact in the house, there's this huge kind of like foyer in the where the staircase is. And there's a giant chandelier that looks like worms. I don't know if anybody else picked on that, but worms is kind of a huge theme in this show. Charles Boone's family has like a history of seeing worms and the worms causing some sort of like manifestation of like madness. And so I thought it was really cool that the chandelier kind of manifested this worm thing. So the aesthetics of the show are really cool. Some of the big scenes that happened that I was like really surprised is like episode 2 opens up with this like birth of a baby that is terrifying. Like I was terrified. Like were you too? That was shocking.
Yeah, because when we see that, we're like, what's this got to do with anything, you know? And you find out obviously a few episodes later, if not like one or two, but they put in some moments where you're just kind of like, what does this have to do with the Boone family and what's going on here? And, you know, it plays in down the line to the story. And, you know, even though it doesn't directly affect the Boone family, it brings about this tension in the town eventually that I think really just shoves Minister Burroughs in one direction. And he's like, well, I got nothing to lose, so let's go fight some vampires with the Boone family. And
yeah,
one thing I wanted to mention is the mill, because Charles comes in having the best of intentions. He's like, I will bring so much money and, you know, jobs to this town, and none of you even want to hear it. You don't even want to try it and see if it works. It's like they are so against the Boone family, and they didn't even know Charles before this. You know, it didn't seem like that anyone knew him as a kid or anything like that. And they were just like, no, we're going to shun you and your family. And we don't really have a good reason for it other than things other people in your family did. Like, that is the most irrational thing ever. And they just stick to their guns on it. And you're like, all right, you're all dumb.
Yeah. And I think Rebecca kind of alludes to it several times, because she, you know, just kind of like has to correct some wrong thinking, like, quite often. And it almost reminded me of like the Salem witch trials, where it was just like, oh, people are falling ill. There's weird things happening, like this baby being born that has some deformities. Let's blame it on someone. Like, let's not talk about, you know, modern, any kind of like modern thinking or any kind of rational thinking or logic. Let's just blame this new family that's moved in, who looks different than us, who has a, you know, history of family trauma. You know, it must be their fault. And then Rebecca kind of like tries to correct all of that thinking, but she also has her own motives. Like, I thought that that was interesting, that she wanted to be this writer. And so she's moving into their family to kind of like leech off of their trauma and write a story about them. So she's kind of like not as innocent and pure and helpful at first.
That I found interesting as well, because it was one of those things where you're like, okay, well, it's Stephen King. We're not surprised there's a writer in the story by any means. There usually is in a lot of his stuff. But yeah, with this, it's not that it felt forced, but her actions towards the family and then what she was writing in secret that we didn't really see either, you know, until she's basically caught red-handed with the story. And
right,
I thought that was a kind of weird way to handle it, honestly, because if we had seen her spending a little more time writing, maybe, obviously she goes home and talks to her mother about it here and there beforehand, but it's not a process we really saw from her. It was more like her looking around. She found those letters between her father and the Boones, and it just felt like that part of the story was a little too condensed for my personal tastes and for the outcome that it had between her and the kids when, you know, the kids find out about it. Loa finds the manuscript or something, and it obviously upsets all of them. And then we're like, oh, okay, we didn't know that was going to happen.
Yeah, Loa is actually a really complicated and not fully formed character for me. She has this disability that's not fully explained. I mean, they do kind of give some reasoning in the doctor's office for what had happened to her, but it doesn't seem to impede her life as much as they play it off to be. Mm-hmm. And then her father seems relatively helpful, but there's a lot of animosity on her behalf towards like what happened to her mom. It seems tied to her, the fact that her mom had died, but she harbors all this resentment towards her father, which really comes into play towards the end. I don't know how much we're allowed to talk about.
All the spoilers.
Okay, so eventually Loa crosses over into the dark side and joins the band of merry vampires in Jerusalem's lot. Like, she fully gives it over. And I was just a little bit confused by that storyline, and also the ending. How did you feel about the ending? Like, should we talk about that yet? Or
we can. I don't mind jumping around. Hopefully the listeners don't mind. But you know, with Loa in particular, you're right. She has all this resentment, and it's like, okay, your dad isn't the one who actually did anything. You know, he had his job, he was doing what he could, and it's never really made clear why the mom and all of the kids were with them on the ship. And you're just like, right. Well, you know, things like that happen at sea, especially in the 1800s. Like, you don't have a whole lot of control over what happens out there. Even today, I would argue you don't have that much control about what happens out there.
Yeah.
And for her to go, you know, to the dark side, like you said, and then still help the family, but also kind of give Jacob what he wants. And it's like her motivations are kind of all over the place. And she's a kid, so it's not like we expect her to have everything figured out, but she seems smart enough to know what she's doing at all times. And not all of it is very logical.
Yeah. And it almost seems like the situation with the shell necklace, like, you know, very early on in the episode, she has this shell necklace that came from her mother. It seems like maybe some of her animosity might be tied to the fact that they had to leave their homeland and come to Chapelwaite. And so early on, she has this thing where her necklace breaks. And then later, Stephen, who's been lurking around in their home undetected, like repairs the necklace and gives it back to her. So I'm wondering if that was kind of like a token of like, look, I'm better than your father. Like, your father didn't give a crap about this shell necklace, but I did. So I don't know if that was like mending the fences and kind of helping her to cross over, but it just did seem like a stretch, like, you know. And then she's running around with vampire teeth towards the end and nobody seems really like that concerned about it.
Yeah, they felt a little inconsistent with some of the vampire tropes because, you know, Charles at the end, to talk about the actual ending, you know, he takes off in like a rowboat after they put the book literally inside him, and the doctor's like, I'm out, don't ever ask me for anything again.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I'm not talking about this, but please go away, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's like dawn or something, and you know, the little vampire child is standing out there and not burning up. Like,
yeah.
I was a little confused because if she was like in the woods, I would get it because you have like the cover from the trees and everything. But they were just out there, like, standing on the shore, waving goodbye to him. And he's on the boat and a vampire now. Like, she is very reluctant to turn him because by the end, she understands that what transpired was partially her fault by giving the book over to Jacob. And then, you know, he's turning to protect her and leaving all of his kids with Rebecca. And I don't really know how they're going to deal with Loa. It's like very much here's an ending, but it's not really an ending.
Well, I don't understand like what they're gonna do. Like, maybe there's gonna be a season two or something, because like we were saying, she is a child of the night. Like, she literally sucks blood and has vampire teeth and looks dead. Like, he definitely looked like a vampire. Like, they way turned him. Like, they made his eyes look a different color and he was very pale and
yeah.
It's very vampiric looking. She almost just looks like she's sickly or something until she like smiles or, you know, whatever. But she's a vampire. Like, what are we going to do with her? She can't go to school. Like, is she going to snack on her siblings?
Yeah, that was something that definitely confused me too. And again, there were a lot of things I did like about this show, but there were still things where I was left like wondering what on earth they were going to do. And you know, you have great effects like you mentioned earlier, like the beheading.
Oh, that was great.
It was so good. And you know, Charles has no qualms with, you know, destroying his own family because they are vampires. Obviously harder when it's his daughter, but for Stephen and Philip, it's like, you guys are screwed.
No, I thought that whole scene, what episode was that called? That was the one about, that was The Keeper, when they actually like go to war with Jerusalem's Lot. So that was episode 10. But yeah, the darkness being called forth from the book, there was a lot of like Latin chanting and bringing forth the end of the world and drowning the world in darkness. And the moon kind of eclipses and there's just this like Death Star almost approach to this, everything just kind of burning out. The stars go out. It's like sucking the stars into itself. It is becoming super dark. So that was really disturbing. I thought that was scary. And then there's like, yeah, this battle for for what is the little town called? Preacher's Corners.
Yes.
Yeah. So all the townspeople go to like Jerusalem's lot to like attack the whole village of vampires. And that was cool. That, I mean, but it did kind of show that I think like Charles Boone is kind of like a weak fighter. Like he always finds himself being choked out often.
Yeah. And, you know, one character we actually haven't mentioned at all yet is Abel. He is also shunned by the town because he's black. And, you know, Charles takes a liking to him, and then Abel takes a liking to Honor. So he's kind of around a little more for a bit there.
Yeah.
But he is a character who is loyal throughout this whole thing. He is a hard worker, and Charles treats him as an equal, which I think is something you definitely did not see all that often in the 1800s by any stretch of the imagination, you know. And to see that and Abel's loyalty and dedication to Charles because of it, I just thought that was a really nice, you know, relationship in the show that wasn't crucial to the plot, really. But without Abel, Charles would have had to do everything himself, basically.
Yeah. Almost like, you know, he understands because he married an islander, I think. So, and then his family are, you know, people of color. And so maybe he just kind of has this tenderness towards that kind of a situation. Abel's definitely, you know, called out by the townspeople often, like that he can't come to certain establishments and probably difficult for him to find employment. But it didn't seem like Preacher's Corners had to deal with that too much. Like there wasn't very much other.
It was just Abel that we saw.
And then now the Boone children.
Right. And with that, you know, because of it, Charles also felt like an outsider, you know, obviously not in the same way, but just because of who his family was and who his children were. And, you know, he had this challenge that you would think most white men would not have in this situation.
Yeah, no, that's really, and the whole mill idea too, I thought that the townspeople were really going to rally around that situation. At first, like I thought, oh, this is a really good idea. And he did a really good job of like presenting it to the townspeople, the preacher being on his side. So like the preacher we should talk about is married to the former preacher's daughter.
Alice.
Yes, Alice. And they had twins who succumbed to some kind of illness and were buried previously before, you know, we're getting started. So that's part of their history. But somewhere in the grief of losing their children, they kind of part ways in a sense. And she kind of clings to her father and he clings to a woman, a younger woman in the community who used to be part of Jerusalem's lot, actually. And she kind of was like a wanton woman for maybe Jacob, I want to say. She was kind of like getting bled out and also doing sexual favors with Jacob, the main guy over there.
Yeah, that was how I understood that whole situation to be as well, because she was definitely ashamed of herself. And she as well was pretty much an outsider because everyone kind of knew that. But man, the former minister, preacher, whatever you want to call them, I think he was the character I hated the most.
Yeah, me too. He was gross and just like very misogynistic and racist and just, yeah, had a really inbred kind of nastiness going on with the whole community and just the way he viewed his family situation and ostracizing people that didn't fit the narrative. He was just like a really nasty person. But I thought it was her death, the young girl who gave birth to the preacher's baby, like, her death was extreme. That's one of the more memorable ones, I think.
Yeah. When they showed you the deaths, they really went all out on showing you the deaths between her, yeah, the decapitation, you know, and then the big fight. There's only a few of them who make it out of that alive. And you really see the damage, especially as they let the church burn. So we kind of see the beginnings of what will eventually be Salem's lot, because Jerusalem's lot has been burned to the ground pretty much.
Right. And Preacher's Corner is just kind of like, well, I mean, The interesting thing about Preacher's Corners is that it was like falling victim to this illness, as well as it was going to be plagued by vampires. So it was kind of doubling down on not doing so well. And the illness, I think, is really key as well, because back in the 1800s, when you buried someone, it was kind of a belief that they could come back as the undead. That it kind of connected like two different folklore that the people of the 1800s kind of believed about death.
Yeah, absolutely. Another thing I wanted to ask you about was sort of the lore behind this whole thing with Jacob, because he's doing this to eliminate all humans. And, you know, that is also terrifying. This is like, you know, even worse than Thanos wanting to get rid of half of the humans.
Yeah, actually, I wanted to tell you that there was a whole episode. Let me see exactly which one. I was kind of cracking up. Okay, so it's episode 7. And it's the one that really just kind of like makes the book known as like the book is where all of this is coming about and has the power contained within it. If, you know, a person of the dark, like Jacob, who worships the worm being the ancient entity. So that's really the lore, is that there's this God, this ancient God that's more powerful than the Christian God of Jesus and all of that Judeo-Christianity. So the ancient worm, more powerful than Satan, more powerful than anything, is being worshipped through this book. And there was almost this like Lord of the Rings vibe in episode 7, because Charles Boone has the book. He digs it up. It was somehow buried with the preacher's dead twins, which was really strange. And he takes on this burden of wanting to destroy the book, just like the ring, and it starts making him crazy. And Rebecca is even like, let me share the load, similar to like this Frodo and Samwise Gamgee relationship. And, you know, I don't know, the whole thing was kind of like almost ridiculous. There are a few over the top moments in the show where you're just like, okay, this is a little over the top. Like tying the book to Mary and sticking her in the bathtub in the cellar was like, wow.
Yeah, I'm flipping through the story again real quick here, and it's funny because this ends on the line, there are some huge rats in the walls by the sound. And, you know, that's something that comes to play pretty much as soon as Charles gets there. It's like the first night or the second night, he's hearing things in the walls, and there's just something about Chapelwaite, I think, that made someone want to adapt the story in this way, obviously. But, you know, just reading the short story, because it's letters, you know, for a lot of us, we're probably like, okay, maybe this is something that's not really going to be adapted because of how it's written. But the way they did it was they focused on this place and this family, and then just kind of worked the story around that and their circumstances, instead of, you know, you just get glimpses in these letters. We're kind of getting a better look at what this actually was like, because, you know, I don't know what the mail system was like in the 1800s, but I imagine it was pretty slow.
Yeah.
So, you know, there was probably a decent amount of time that lapsed between each of the letters that we're seeing, and, you know, they're dated, so you can see that in the short story itself. But the way this is adapted, I think, works well for TV. Like, you have to cater to the medium that you're working in.
Yeah, sure enough. Yeah. And I mean, for me personally, I think I kind of fluctuated back and forth between being very engaged in the show and really enjoying it to, I don't know, oftentimes just kind of just challenged a little bit. Because I did feel like there was some inconsistency in some plot holes. I mean, people grow on you eventually. Like, I don't think that I was extremely into the Charles and Rebecca relationship. I didn't think that they had a lot of chemistry. I thought that it was kind of like a Disney romance where it's like love at first sight kind of thing, where you're just like, it's not believable.
Yeah.
Plus he's not super warm and friendly. Like, who would fall in love with this man? I have no idea. He doesn't seem like the most awesome father, in my opinion. He seems kind of like not really around. Like, there's so much to the story that's happening. You don't really see intimate moments of the family just being family, if you get my sense.
Yeah. We don't see like Sunday dinners or anything like that. And, you know, it's very clear that Charles Boone is a man who is very good at being at sea.
Yeah.
That is made very clear from the start. And, you know, they even sort of fall off on the whole mill storyline, because it's like, some of the guys didn't want to go work. And then it was like, that was the end of that. And I think there were a lot of loose ends in this. And, you know, sometimes Stephen King stories themselves have those, because he's always thinking of ways to bring characters back, depending on the characters, you know, especially with characters like recently Holly Gibney. She's in all three of the Bill Hodges books. She's in The Outsider. She gets her own story in If It Bleeds, you know. Clearly, she's a character who can keep coming back because of the nature of her work. And with this, you mentioned the possibility of a season two earlier. I just don't see where they go with it, because it's like, which characters do we follow? Do we just follow Rebecca and the kids? And that's kind of it. Do we visit more of Salem's Lot and see that being built back up? Like, it's a little unclear to me where they would pick up, because with all of the loose ends that they left, you can't pick them up without Charles.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess I was unsatisfied with the ending then. I think it's just, it was really like they didn't know how to finish the story. And I almost feel bad for Rebecca. It's sort of like he just kind of dumped his kids off on her. They had some sort of like, maybe they fell in love somewhere along the line. They clearly had feelings for each other, but then it's like, okay, see you later. Here's all my kids. Have a nice life.
One's a vampire. Good luck.
have a nice life. Yeah. So I just kind of was like, well, how? Like, I don't know. Like, maybe later they could explore, yeah, just like the beginnings of Salem's Lot, which is another interconnected story. You know, there's Jerusalem's Lot, the novelette. Then there's the novel Salem's Lot with, you know, Marlowe and all of that kind of thing. So who knows? I don't know. But I mean, for me personally, as an adaptation, there's a lot of creative license that they took with the story. And obviously, because they made it into a 10 episode miniseries, but it does say season one. I don't know. They put a lot in there that wasn't, you know, originally there in the text. But like you said, they were building out, here's what we think could have been the reason for that and the backstory for different situations. So I enjoyed it for the most part, but I did think that there was some stuff that just wasn't fleshed out enough.
For me, where this show was able to shine was in the creepy factor. The horror elements of this worked really well, but the character elements, less so, which King is great at character work. That's one of the reasons why I love reading his work, because he puts so much detail and time into these characters to make you fall in love with them. But in this, I don't know which characters we're supposed to love.
Right. Yeah, I felt the same way. I felt the same way, because definitely Charles Boone is flawed. The children were not really developed. They were more just kind of there as pawns to move about. Like, Lola had maybe the most of a storyline, but the other two children were just kind of like, like every episode, they're just kind of like, what is happening?
And then we're like, oh, okay, Honor knows how to shoot now. Great. Yeah, she's useful.
Yeah, in some capacity, yes. Or there to just be a love interest for this, the Abel character.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, unfortunately, they weren't super developed. Rebecca is developed to a degree, but she also just kind of like, I don't know, she's very just kind of one-dimensional, and then fell in love with this guy who's not giving anything back to her.
Yeah, she kind of is there to exist and, you know, be the writer in the story.
Yep, I agree.
So is there anything else you want to mention before we dive into ratings here?
No, I think I'm good with going into that.
Okay, so I typically just do ratings out of 5, because where most of the things get rated is Letterboxd, which is not the case for all of the TV stuff, but most of my stuff is there. So I just stick with out of 5. And, you know, for me, this one's tough because it had elements that I liked, but it just wasn't quite all the way there. And I don't think I regret watching it.
No.
I think I'm okay having spent almost 10 hours watching it, you know, somewhere between 8 and 10 with the episode length. But, you know, I think at most I can give this a 3 out of 5. You know, it was fine. I really loved the set pieces. I really loved, you know, the kills and that stuff, which obviously those things are very important for horror stories. If you don't get the setting right and you don't get the kills right, you can really just like end up hating something. But for me, those things outperformed the characters. And I don't think that's necessarily great.
Yeah, that's a really fair rating. As I'm thinking about it and sitting here and, you know, really exploring it, there is a lot to love for horror fans, like you said. There's the haunted house thing, there's some asylum stuff, there's vampires, there's gossip and town, like small town horror where everybody's in everybody's business. There's creepy kids, there's Satan's Mass, you know, there's just like, there's lots of stuff for horror fans to appreciate and love and look forward to.
The end of the world, almost.
The end of the world, apocalyptic. But for me personally, as somebody who really enjoys character development and investing in those characters, I think that all of them were a little too thin. They were mostly there to just support the big kills and the special effects and the aesthetic. And then, yeah, as a diehard fan, diehard fans are going to find some issue with making this a 10-episode miniseries with a 30-page, like you said, novelette. So there's a lot of creative license there. But I would give it a 3 as well, actually. I think 4 is too generous, and I think a 2 is not enough.
Yeah, it's something I struggle with TV shows in particular, because you can watch something like the first season of Castle Rock, and you have the Queen episode that everyone really spoke out about, and you know, it was a moment for Sissy Spacek to shine in particular. And you could have like one truly amazing episode within a series, but then you're like, okay, if the other episodes don't, you know, come even close, you kind of end up falling more towards the middle. And honestly, a lot of things end up being a 3 out of 5, and yeah, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Like, you're not going to have something that is perfect every single time, especially as broad as King's works are.
Yeah. And, you know, in terms of Castle Rock, for me, you know, like the first one really fell down a little bit, but the second one really picked up. So I do really enjoy the season 2 of Castle Rock. And then as far as King adaptations go, it's just like, it's really hard to land a punch and to really deliver like King can in his words and in his text and the way that he does. So, I mean, it's fair to give it a shot. I would definitely recommend this show to people. But yeah, don't go in there thinking it's going to be, you know, totally like exactly what you want, because it's not.
Yeah. You also have the fact too, that I kind of wish they would bring back doing like anthologies along the lines of Creepshow. I know Creepshow is a current show, but that has a certain campiness to it that I think not all of King's stories work for. So I would love to see more stuff like Cat's Eye and, you know, these feature length releases that have 3 stories in them. And that could be a very cool way to cover a lot of things like this, because we both know this didn't need to be 10 episodes. We talked about how the whole first half of the first episode was like, we didn't really need this. Like, they literally could have started with showing the mom sick and, you know, wrapping her up and tossing her into the sea. And that's all we needed about her death. We didn't need like this whole elongated scene, yeah, where they're slowly going through the motions with it. And then boom, they could have arrived at Chapelwaite. And, you know, I think that would have hit a little better for how they opened the show, because you don't want to take too long to get to the main location, especially when it's a location as big and I don't even know the word for it, but it just stands out like Chapelwaite does.
Yeah. And there, you know, like you said, that there's a reason why we're showing up to watch this show. And it's a horror show. And oftentimes with the small town drama, it just kind of felt a little house on the prairie, like a creepy little house on the prairie, where it was like the sickness and this woman who's so upset because she can't find her husband and her daughter's dead and they're blaming it on people. It was like, okay. Like, we don't need a whole episode dedicated to this scenario. Like, let's get back to Satan's Mass.
Yeah. And the fact that Alice kills the minister too, after that entire storyline, we didn't even mention that. So I'm going back a little here, but yeah, these kills were pretty good. So, you know, I had to give it credit for that, but
definitely.
I would recommend watching this too, if you have the time. I know these adaptations can be hit or miss, but I think this one is done well enough to at least grab some part of your attention and sort of reel you in, because I was definitely more invested in, okay, you know, what's going to happen with the vampires in particular. And, you know, you mentioned the asylum too, and it's like that was kind of just left off as well. And you're like, okay, we're not really revisiting that. All right. And you're just like,
yeah, it was really just for an episode.
Yeah. So it is going to be hit or miss with a lot of people, I think, if they haven't watched it by now. And again, with it being on Epix, that's a little harder to kind of market this to the massive King fan base.
Yeah, I'm wondering if at some point it will get sold to, you know, like an HBO Max or Netflix or something, like things often do, you know, like The Walking Dead starting off on A&E, but then, you know, finding it's like a forever home over on Netflix. Like, you know, that's a possibility.
Yeah. Was Walking Dead A&E? AMC.
AMC, excuse me.
Yeah. So many acronyms. I totally get it.
And so many streaming services. Like, please stop. Like,
yeah.
At this point, we all left cable and Dish TV to go ahead and start getting these apps so that we could watch our show. But like, I cannot afford another gosh dang app.
See, I'm with my parents right now, and the deal is they basically pay for the cable TV, which comes with, like, they added Showtime to our plan for free and a couple of the services, and then I just pay for all the streaming services. So it's like a nice even split.
Yeah, that's a great deal. I mean, I do have some adult children, and they get certain ones, and then we share login information.
Yeah.
I mean, like, Hulu and Discovery and...
They're all doing it.
And YouTube, it's like, no. And at some point you have to draw the line. So when Epix was like, hey, who wants to pre-screen? I was just like, me want to pre-screen because I'm not getting Epix. Sorry, Epix.
No, I think it's something that they definitely understand. Like, not all reviewers, whether you're writing about it or podcasting about it, are going to have every single streaming service that there
Absolutely
is.
Not.
I've come close, but you know, I think there's a bunch of interesting things in the works too for Stephen King. So I'm looking forward to that. At the time that I am recording this with you, Sadie, this is the last episode I have on the schedule because there's nothing else coming out.
Yeah.
There's nothing else coming in 2021. And I won't have anything again until it looks like February of 2022 when the third Gwendy's book comes out. So, you know, I am closing in here on getting these episodes done very, very early. You know, we are, just for, you know, timing's sake, we are recording this on September 5th, 2021. So we're a few months ahead here.
Yeah. If it's releasing, this episode will be on air in January, you said, of 2022.
Yeah. Well, Sadie, thank you so much for joining me. Again, everyone, go check out Nightworms if you love having physical books around, as Sadie can see, I sure do.
Yeah, that's a great collection. I was totally stocking your shelves.
Well, thank you. And hopefully I can have you back on in the future for some other types of episodes. I'm still kind of working that out at this point in time, but you are welcome back on anytime.
Yeah, I love Chat Cemetery. I love talking about Stephen King. I'm definitely here for it. So thank you so much for having me.